Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thank you. Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half of your host, Aaron Bresnitz, with Leah Farazani. I get that right?
You did.
The owner, founder of Semolina Artisanal Pasta. And I always get this wrong with the pastai as well.
Pastaya.
Pastaya.
Yeah.
Which is for people at home who don't know.
That's the feminine of pasta maker in Italian.
Always male and female there.
I know.
I never got a knack for it. Now, you know, when people think of delicious, organic semolina pasta, Los Angeles may not be the first city that springs to mind.
No way.
Yeah. I'm sure that when you got started and as you've grown notoriety, people have been like, I'm sorry, where did you say you were from?
Yeah.
But before we get to the building of the budding and growing pasta empire in L.A., where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
Kind of a split personality. I was born in New York.
Okay.
On Long Island. And I lived there until I was about 10. And then my family moved to Southern California, about an hour north of Los Angeles.
So, okay. So you can claim Los Angeles, California. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
But you don't want to give up New York status?
Here's the thing, is I didn't realize how California I'd become.
Oh, yeah.
Until I moved back to New York.
I think that's what happens.
And then you were like, oh man, like, okay, the food is great, the nightlife is great, the city is awesome, but I gotta tell you, people work way too hard.
Oh my god. Well, I think they work differently.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, just go into work, get your work done, go home. Don't do the thing where, like, go to work, hang out for an hour and a half. You know, it's just like, just go, just do your work.
Totally. Totally. So, I mean, I moved there. I had just finished my master's in journalism. I was working first for a magazine, and then, you know, as often happens, you end up in some form of restaurant life to be able to fund your creative world. And I was trying to find a paying magazine job, and got a job managing a restaurant in Tribeca.
What, do you want to shout it out?
It was called Le Zinc. It's okay. Sadly defunct. It was a small bistro that was associated with David Waltuck's Chanterelle. It was owned by Karen and David Waltuck. So I walked into that job supposed to be their brunch manager.
Sure.
And then the GM got fired 2 weeks later, and I became the AGM, like, overnight.
That's very New York. I mean, that's very New York. Now, before that, you know, had you been drawn to food, or did you see food as just sort of, you know, the outside career to support a different creative career?
Food had always been the outside career to support a different career. I had, you know, my undergraduate degree is in poetry, my master's is in journalism, and food was something that I had always done to kind of get me where I was going. Mm-hmm. So I'd been working in cafes and restaurants since I was 14. It wasn't really actually until both my experience at Le Zinc, and then I worked at also now the sadly defunct Enoteca a little bit. Once I got my real dream job, which was in publishing, I was an editorial assistant at HarperCollins. And
were you writing about food?
At the time, I wasn't. The roster of writers that we worked with, the editor that I worked with, was like Michael Crichton.
Sure.
And it was just like complete other end of the
spectrum.
And
his food scenes were very much like lawyer, stakeout and car, eating fast food.
Yeah, well, I know. The perfect, even better example, we also worked with Elmore Leonard. So, like, very much lawyers, you know, somebody staked out in a car eating a burger dripping with fat.
Of course.
But nonetheless, it never entered my mind to write about food. It was always the thing I was doing, but I started getting much more passionate about my food there and kind of took all of the things that I had learned in school as an undergraduate in Sonoma County, where all of a sudden, I really cared about where my food came from because the farms were all around me and the dairies were all around me. And so that started to synthesize with this much more refined sense about food. And then I moved back to California.
Did you have a watershed moment Well, first off, what was it like working at Inoteca during like that era in New York City?
Oh my God. So, well, I mean, I worked two nights a week. Just to be able to pay my rent.
Sure.
Because I was making, what, 28 grand a year to work in publishing. I took a nice fat pay cut from the restaurants. and I was like, my boss was like, you need to wear nicer clothes. I was like, you need to pay me more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then finally I was just like, I need to go to a job to help support, you know, my desire to work in publishing. So I went and I talked to my friends who owned Inoteca, and I was like, can I just come and wait tables a couple nights a week? And it was madness. We'd work till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was just droves and droves of people and like eating amazingly good food and drinking amazingly good wine until very late into the night. It was so much fun.
Did you have a
little bit of a bacchanal.
Oh my God.
All ends.
Of course. I feel like the amount of sleep you get is sort of like tied to the amount of money you make when you first move to New York. Like the least amount of money you make is the least amount of sleep you get, but it's also some of like the happiest you ever are.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a really fun time. It was very exhausting. And kind of to the point where this all started was I realized that I could be the hardest worker in Slackerland and have a much better balance to my life.
Is Slackerland Los Angeles?
California in general. and have a much better balance to my life and not have those conversations like, how many hours did you work this week as a point of pride?
I know. It's like, well, anyway, we don't have enough time for that. Anyway,
that's so a whole other show.
We'll just get every ex-New Yorker moved to California went, you guys are fucking crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I picked up stakes and I moved back to Tahoe.
Nice.
Which was where I had gone periodically to figure out what I wanted to do when I grow up.
Sure.
And it was there that I made my first attempt at food writing.
Really? So what was your first approach? Now, and second part follow-up to that question, did someone ask you to write about food, or you're like, I'm going to be a food writer?
Somebody asked me to write about food.
Okay.
I had a friend, so I was writing about science. I was actually the editor for an online outdoor sports magazine called Mountain Zone. So I wrote about skiing and snowboarding and rock climbing and ultra marathoning and all sorts of adventure sports. And I was also working in a cafe because that didn't pay particularly well. And I got to be really good friends with somebody who was associated with a newspaper editor in Tahoe. And she was like, you should really write a story about, if I remember this correctly, the thing that she wanted me to write about was a little panaderia in King's Beach. I had been writing about something that she was doing at the Boys and Girls Club prior to that. And I was like, oh, that'd be really fun. And all of a sudden it clicked.
It just clicked.
It was like, they always told you, write what you know.
Sure.
Well, there's nothing that I know more about than food.
Now, had you gotten this knowledge of food of working in the restaurant, or had it always been there with the family, or, you know, how you grew up?
A combination of the two. So I was the kid who was into food from the get-go. I planned you get to pick what you're going to eat for your birthday dinner. I was the one who, in seventh grade, because I had a friend who was Greek, that I wanted to go out to Greek food and, like, explore spanakopita and gyros and whatever it was.
And your friends are like, we wanted pizza.
Yeah, like, could we pick something a little bit more approachable, Leah?
So it's always been there.
It's just always kind of been there. And very early in college, I realized that I had a passion for feeding people.
Mm.
Even though, like, I never connected it to my restaurant life, I bribed the guy upstairs from us who sold Cutco knives.
Mm.
I really wanted a good knife. So I was like, how many dinners do I have to make you to get a Cutco knife? And so, like, I made it a habit. But we started, even early in college, we had nights where we made dinner and we would feed all of our friends. And those were my best times in college, was when I was inviting people over. By the time I hit grad school, I was throwing dinner parties for like 20 people because it was just fun.
So hosting, managing, talking about food, feeding people, just everything comes together, and you write this article, and what happens?
It was just really exciting to see in print. I mean, it was the Tahoe World or the Sierra Sun or something like that. It was something nobody would ever see outside of Tahoe.
Of course.
But it really made sense to me. It was the least painful thing I ever had to write. And I'm sure as a content creator and a lot of other creatives can admit that there are times where, like, putting things down on the page can be really, really difficult. I will never remember who said it, but I don't like writing. I like having written. I was always that kind of writer. And so for me, I would get mired in the research and have so much fun, but not ever be able to really get much on the page. But when I started writing about food, that became much easier because it was something that just the synapses in my brain connected on. And so I could quickly translate what I was thinking into words.
And all this time you're cooking on the side, you're cooking more. Are you doing more food recipe testing? Are you writing in that way? Or are you just doing like profile pieces? How did you start making that jump to writing about food, working in food, and then making food?
I think, you know, the more I was writing about food, the more I started exploring with my cooking. Mm-hmm. And when I moved from Tahoe down to Southern California, I got a job working at Mozza as their number two. And
just a little old restaurant.
Kind of fell into that gig. And that really was another major shift for me.
Talk about a temple of pasta and Italian food. And
yeah, though it was the pizzeria. So we didn't have any pasta, but just
the pizzeria.
Seeing the methodology and the approach to food. And then I had launched a food blog called Spicy Salty Sweet.
Okay.
And kind of, you know, my shtick was that I made everything from scratch because I liked to know how things came together, and being in that culinary environment, really, it made a lot of sense. And so I started making pasta from scratch at home.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about how that pasta making at home turned into the Semolina artisanal pasta company that you have today. We have a song coming up from the archives live here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Smart enough to make your mistakes and act like you want them. Walk off the residual pain. Get how you got it. If nice guys finish last anyway, well, that's just your problem. If you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you want this, I want it more. If you want this, I want it more. If you want this, I want it more than you. I want it more than you. It's fine to say this isn't a game when you've already lost it. It's pointless to go through it again, but perhaps you've forgotten. You gotta know there's nothing to gain, so why even bother? If you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you want this, I want it more. If you want this, I want it more. If you want this, I want it more than you. I want it more than you. This isn't a trick. Stop overthinking everything. Just finish your drink and stop overthinking everything now. you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you're the nice guy, act like the nice guy. If you want this, I want it more. If you want this, I want it more. If you want this, I want it more than you. I want it more than you. I want it more than you. I want it more than you.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Leah Ferrazzani, founder, owner, Pastaya.
We'll get you it. Oh we'll get God. It by the end.
No, don't even, don't call my French instructors, don't call my Spanish instructors. Founder of Semolina Artisanal Pasta here in Los Angeles. So, you're working at Moza, and you started making pasta on the side. How did it go from hobby to going, I'm going to make a business out of this?
Well,
and it doesn't have to be that, like, 1-2 jump.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't a 1-2 jump. I left Moza and started as the writer and editor for K&L Wine Merchants for about 7.5 years.
How was that?
It was fun. I mean, I wrote about booze all day. How could you complain?
A lot of good wine. A lot of really good wine.
A lot of really bad wine.
More bad wine, right?
Fortunately, no, not more bad wine. I had the benefit of not having to drink that.
Yeah.
I had to write profiles about it sometimes, but I didn't have to drink it.
You're like, no.
You're like, there are not enough adjectives in the world to describe this.
And you can go to thesaurus.com. Terrible. Let me see this. So, you write for kind
There were some phrases, that some key phrases that we used at that time.
So you're writing for them, but the pasta's on the side, right?
Pasta's on the side. I'm making everything from scratch. Anything that I can imagine. I'm making pasta from scratch. I'm making ice cream from scratch. Just, like, very focused on, like, learning as much as I can. Then I have my first kid.
Okay.
And this is where it really all starts to come together. All that free time.
Gone.
Absolutely. And I'm lamenting how I used to get to make pasta from scratch. And now I have to buy pasta like everybody else. And I start to try and find something that goes with my values. So I'm looking for organic. I'm looking for locally made. And I can't find it.
Well, there's no giant locally made packaged pasta scene in Los Angeles?
There is not.
What year is this?
This was in 2011.
Okay.
The end of 2011 is when my son was born. So beginning of 2012 is when I'm really starting to look around. And then I get pregnant with my second. And I'm starting to feel a little less, like, psyched about my booze writing gig. You know, I have two kids. My metabolism changes. I can't drink quite the way I used to, which makes writing about booze far less fun.
I had one sip on a Tuesday night, and then that was it.
Yeah. And anyway, I'm still kind of in that mode where, like, I'm looking for this thing, and I can't find it. And my husband and I are talking a lot more about, like, what I'm going to do next with my life. And I come downstairs one day, and I, not long after my daughter was born, and I just say, I'm going to make pasta. And my husband looks at me, and he's like, that's a really good idea.
And you go,
I had no idea what that actually meant.
Right. And so you went from, I'm going to make pasta for myself for dinner parties to I'm going to make, did you know in that moment, you're like, I'm going to make pasta and sell it and turn it into a business?
Yes. That was the, like, we had been like, oh, maybe I'll be a writing consultant. Maybe I'll do PR again, blah, 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 blah. And he kept coming back and saying, don't you want to do something with your hands? Don't you want to feed people? Don't you, like, what you're telling me you're going to do for a living doesn't really jive with everything that you say that you want to be doing with your life. So let's rethink this. And then all of a sudden, it just was, you know, back from Whole Foods yet another time, back from Monsieur Marcel, and I'm like, why is it all imported from Italy? Hmm. I took one quick Google search to figure out that we actually export about half the durum wheat that we grow in the U.S. to Italy for them to make into pasta to send back to us.
Wow.
Where I was just like, well, that's absurd.
It's like, let me cut out some of those steps.
That doesn't seem... So it's not a matter of raw ingredients, which I had always assumed that they made great pasta because they had great wheat.
But we have it here.
But it's ours.
It's ours.
So
how long did the recipe testing take from the moment you walked down those stairs with your big proclamation?
About 18 months of R&D.
How much pasta were you eating?
A lot.
How much pasta were your friends eating?
A lot.
How sick of pasta were you by the end?
Never sick of us.
That's correct. But what was that process like? So you knew you wanted to use a certain type of flour.
Right.
So that's a huge sort of, that like sort of sets the base. And you knew you wanted to be organic and you knew you wanted to have certain parameters. So did that help sort of shape your direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that ultimately made it really easy, right? I make dry pasta. It's one ingredient. Besides the flour, it's the water.
Sure.
You know, I knew I didn't want to make egg pasta, at least not out of the gate.
No.
You know, anything perishable scared the daylights out of me as far as the food business went. And all the greatest dried pasta is made from semolina and water, and that's all you need. So I started doing research, and I quickly discovered that there are no books written in English about how to make dried pasta.
Fine.
So I had to rustle up those journalistic skills.
Yeah, good thing you had that.
Start the deep dive. And, I mean, it was, there's this guy who's a professor of cereal sciences at North Dakota State University. Maybe he'll tell me something.
Sure.
And so emails off to him and emails off to this other guy. And I just started piecing information together. And one of the best pieces of advice I got was from Emilio Mitidieri, who owns Pasta Biz up in San Francisco, who I had called to find out how much it cost to buy a pasta dryer. And he's like, you don't need a pasta dryer. You just need to build yourself a cabinet, control the humidity, and dry it in there. And it was like, okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Sure.
Why not?
How are those carpentry skills?
My carpentry skills suck, but fortunately my father-in-law is a handyman.
There you go.
And what we ended up doing was moving our washer and dryer out of our kitchen and into our garage, and we converted my laundry room into a pasta dryer.
As one does.
We tiled the walls, the ceiling, the floor. I had a bunch of consumer electronics totally MacGyvered together.
Hmm.
A couple of incubator hygrostats, a Vicks vaporizer, a space heater, and some carefully positioned box fans with a CPU unit computer fan mounted into the window for exhaust.
Wow.
And that's how I set about, like, really dialing in my drying.
So, 18 months have passed.
Yeah.
You have the product that you're happy with, everyone's happy with.
Yeah.
How did you, at this time, were you also figuring out the branding, launching a business? What was it like, you know, with no local direct competitors? Was the larger pasta world supportive? Or did they just were like, you were so far away from everyone else, it didn't really matter?
I actually don't think the larger pasta world realized I existed until Fancy Food 2 months ago.
Okay.
Where Barilla and someone from Barilla and someone from DiCecco came by my booth and were like, oh, you're making pasta, la la la. You know, it's, oh, we can tell you're using bronze dyes. And it's like, yes, of course.
Yes.
And the guy from Barilla, he's like, oh, you know, so how much are you making? I was like, well, not as much as you.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, I'm pretty sure you make 10,000 pounds an hour, right? And he's like, yeah. I was like, well, I made 12,000 pounds last year.
Right.
And he's like, okay.
But you are making local pasta in LA.
Yeah.
So what is your process? Because you do actually have, so you make 12,000 pounds a year, right? But you have some certain specialty practices, the dyes you use. You just mentioned you use a bronze cutter versus Teflon, right?
So if you think of my pasta machine as a giant Play-Doh fun factory, and you change the discs and that changes the shape of the pasta, mine are not made out of Teflon, which is what most big industrial pasta makers use. They're made out of brass or bronze. And that metal creates some really nice drag on the pasta as it comes out. And so the pasta has some texture on the surface, which helps it hold sauce. I dry all of the pasta very slowly and at low temperatures. My my drying times are 16 to 20 hours per batch.
What's an industrial, just to give?
4 hours, maybe. They dry at about 185 degrees. I dry at 95 to 110 is my max.
It's like a nice sauna.
It's like a nice sauna. It's very much like basically the Bay of Naples. It's what weather is like in Gragnano off the Bay of Naples. It's a slight breeze with a schwitz, and it just kind of slowly dries out the pasta from the core.
Now you have the pasta
and
you're happy with everything.
Yeah.
No one's really giving you any guff about it.
Yeah.
It seems like there are people around America who are helping you figure things out, give you a little knowledge like that. How did you launch? How did you build a brand? How did you get into stores?
A lot of moxie, ultimately.
I thought you said it was only two ingredients in the pasta.
Just two ingredients, flour and water.
Where does the moxie fit in?
Got it.
Thank you.
He'll be here later, folks.
Yeah, the 10:30 show is quite different. Was it like you in a car with the pasta in your trunk?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I launched the brand at Artisanal LA, thinking that it would be a really great opportunity to go direct to the people that I was intending to have buy the pasta.
And what year is this?
This is October of 2014.
Okay.
A couple of days before that, Nan Kohler from Grist and Toll, which is our local flour mill here, asked if she could have a couple of cases of pasta so that she could sell it in her store, and I dropped off some samples to Leah Fierro at Milk Farm, which is a really great cheese shop here in Eagle Rock. And a couple hours later, she calls me back. She's like, I want a case of each cut. I want to have it in the store before you launch, which was so exhilarating.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just this, like, amorphous thing anymore. I had two retailers going into, like, my first, like, show where I got to have people try it, and the reception was phenomenal. I got a handful more accounts out of doing Artisanal LA. One of them was Monsieur Marcel. They were beautiful, very early adopter. And I felt like I'd arrived already, because to me, you know, Monsieur Marcel, Farm Shop, Milk Farm, they're arbiters of taste here in LA. Grist and Toll. I moved very organically. I was a cottage food operation, so I couldn't really go very far. And I could only make so much out of my laundry room.
You're still producing out of your house.
Still producing
out of my house. What's the legality on that?
That was totally legal.
Yeah?
It was totally legal. So I had a cottage food license. I had their Class B, so I was legal to produce for wholesale, but I couldn't sell across county lines, and I couldn't sell online. And they cap you at, like, $55,000 a year.
Wow.
Revenue.
And then when did you make the next jump? What made you go to the next level? Because now you're not doing it out of the house anymore.
Right. So I moved in April of 2015 in advance of when I thought I would, because an opportunity opened up. I learned about a facility that was about to open at the time called LA Prep, is kind of the first of its kind. Mm-hmm. In the country, where it's a independent makers in their own rooms to produce stuff, but then you share certain things like dish pit and dry storage and
all the stuff for it, which is great.
Right. So I couldn't use one of the shared commercial kitchens because my pasta takes 20 hours to dry, and I have all this specialized equipment. Nobody's like rolling a 500-pound pasta extruder in and out of a building every time they have to make pasta. So I needed that opportunity for the next step, and it was just very fortuitous that I was able to get in. Unfortunately, my plan had moved into their like tiniest space. And about 3 weeks before we were supposed to move in, I was looking at my racks compared to the space that I had allotted for the dryer based on the specs that I had gotten. And the racks were bigger than the dryer space.
Yikes.
And I called the company that was importing it, and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, our specs on that dryer were off by about 2.5 feet.
Just a small thing.
Just a small thing. So all of a sudden, my plan for this tiny little production space was not going to fit. And I needed to move to a bigger kitchen. But because I was moving in LA Prep, I had a little bit of flexibility. And so I was able to move into a bigger space. I kickstarted a pasta dryer.
Awesome.
Raised $25,000 from some of the most amazing, supportive people I can possibly imagine. I mean, I really went for it. I personally messaged every single person I had ever met on Facebook, sure, LinkedIn, wherever. But then, you know, being on Kickstarter, a bunch of people who I'd never met found me and supported me. And they are the people who to this day will send me like little encouraging emails like, "Hey, saw that you just landed your first Whole Foods. We're so proud of you. Like, keep up the good work." And like that to me, like at some very hard times in the business, has kept me going.
I mean, I can only imagine. So now that you're up and running, you're in the large space, fancy food shows, what's now, what's next, what's the plan?
Yeah, so we're kind of at another big turning point for the business. I am in 21 Whole Foods locations.
Amazing. So are you able to cross state lines?
I'm able to cross state lines.
Okay,
I have retailers all over the country, but you know, our goal really is to be a great regional brand to start. I think that, you know, I need to serve my community before I start sending my pasta everywhere on the continental U.S. and then some. And so I'm really focused on Southern California right now. I had a meeting last week with Gelson's.
Mm.
Fingers crossed. We had a meeting a few weeks ago with Bristol Farms. So we're working on trying to do that and just make it accessible. We're picking up Jimbo's down in San Diego.
Oh, awesome.
So we're going to be available a lot more places and hopefully be in a lot more kitchens.
Awesome. Soon. And one last question.
Sure.
What are the types of pasta you make?
We make six shapes right now. We make conchiglie and conchiglie pastina, which are two different sizes of shell. We make strozzapreti, which is a little twisty shape, rigatoni, penne rigate, and fusilli.
And what's your favorite?
Ooh, the strozzapreti.
Oh. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. If people want to get your pasta, if they want to buy it online, because now it can be shipped anywhere.
Yes.
Anywhere in the world?
Anywhere in the world, sure. Yeah, why not?
Sure. Send it to Italy, not in wheat form, in final form.
Exactly.
Where can they go?
Semolinapasta.com.
Do you have an Instagram?
I do. Semolina Artisanal Pasta.
Was the other one taken?
Just Semolina?
Yeah, Semolina Pasta. Maybe.
You know, I don't even remember if I tried.
How's your Instagram game?
My Instagram game is pretty good. You know, I am balancing two kids in a nascent business.
Sure.
So
three kids.
Three kids. So we don't post three times a day.
That's fine. Some people shouldn't.
But I make sure that when I post something, it's meaningful.
Awesome. Well, the pasta is meaningful. Ellie appreciates it. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. We have another song coming up from the archives of Snacky Tunes and a live performance next here on heritageradionetwork.org.
I wish everyone so kind of all they have is nothing much at all. You were all I knew, so now I dream.
my name. My heart's dead anyway. I build walls up deep inside my mind, and I'm keeping the world out as long as I'm alive. But one day you and I will go to sleep, and not wake up. Where can we go from here, and how am I supposed to give a fuck?
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
All right,
here we go. I mean, every time I think that we've had a band that is squeezed in here,
someone comes in and steps in.
And they fit in. We are...
I mean, let's just go through the gear in the room. We got an amp. We got a ton of amps outside.
Three amps.
Congas.
Four toms.
Drum pad.
Vibe.
Own mixer.
Some other vibes. A bassist.
Bass.
A sound guy.
I kind of like that you described your drum machine as vibes. With his vibes right there.
Litany of pedals.
Vibes. Yeah, yeah. We got a lot of pedals in here.
I don't see
them. They're there. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
Our first fall guest. Although it's still kind of summerish outside. Who are you guys?
The name of the band is Sin Cane. Brooklyn band. I'm here with Mikey Freedom Heart Ish, the Man of Steel Aaron, and J Tram.
So why don't you give our listeners a little background on where you guys come from, how you came together?
I started the band a while ago.
Oh, introduce yourself too.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
I'm Ahmed Gallup, and I write the music for the group, and I started the band almost 7 years ago. I was living in Ohio. I'm originally from Sudan. And I put out two records and kind of got picked up by a bunch of different bands to tour. So I kind of put the group in the back burner. But then I moved to New York and I decided I wanted to move on forward with this project. So I revamped it. I met J Tram when we were playing in Yesair together. And through, you know, living in New York, I met Mikey Freedom Heart here, and he brought along the rest of the crew, Ish and Aaron Steele.
So when you pick up a group after, you know, you have two records and you go on tour with a bunch of them and come back, you know, what did you learn and bring into this time around that was different from the first time out?
Oh, man. Well, I had like the blessing of touring the world and really kind of see a bunch of people do the right thing and a bunch of people do the wrong thing. So, I mean, it really puts a lot into perspective. I know what I'm getting myself into now. When before I was like 23-year-old kid, didn't know anything. I was just kind of making music all willy-nilly. And now it's given me a lot of focus, you know?
No names, but examples of one person doing the right thing and one person doing the wrong thing. You can choose which is first.
Yeah. Choose whatever you want. Yeah.
But no names. We don't call people out.
Mr. X and...
Well, yeah. I mean, I've worked with a lot of really like super organized people who just are very honest and straight up. I mean, that's one big thing I've learned is to be straight up and honest. And if you're not straight up and honest, then it creates a lot of anxiety and tension. And that's just, I mean, I guess that's all I can really say. I mean, the right thing is to be honest. The wrong thing is to drink too much.
He's talking to me.
Get it together, Mikey Freedom Wars.
God
bless. But so now that you're back in Britain, so how long has this incarnation been together?
Not even a year. I mean, Mikey and I and J-Tram, we started playing together in what, like December or
it was
January?
After the only snow that happened last year, so it was either
in January.
October.
No, it was the last weekend in October.
Yeah,
the 28th.
So yeah, it started a little like slow. I was touring with Eleanor Friedberger at the time, and so I didn't really have as much time as I do now. And then we had a few bass players that we played with, but Ish came through in May. And we've been playing with him. And then just for this, because we want to do something special, we brought Aaron along. But
yeah, why don't we get a tune? You guys need, like, what, 10 seconds of noise and then start it? Yeah. Or do you guys feel?
I think we're going to see.
Jack, how do we sound out there? Can I get a thumbs up? Okay. All right, so let's get for the room, and then we can start.
All right.
We all lighten up.
awesome. You guys are going to do us a big disservice because now everyone's going to want to bring all this gear in because it sounds so good. It's like,
go big or go home.
It's one guy and acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of effects.
That vibes pad is really putting out a lot of vibes.
We haven't even used it yet.
Oh, really? Oh.
Vibes pad comes on the next one.
Oh, okay. That is amazing.
That's a really amazing sound.
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of live mixing here. It sounds awesome, guys. So... now the band's together, new record, right?
Yeah, the record's coming out next month, October 23rd on DFA.
Oh, okay. So how did that come about? Or what was the recording process, since you guys have only been together for less than a year?
Well, I played drums on it, but these and other people came and did random things.
I recorded it pretty much by myself. I did maybe 85% of the record myself, and then in the process of recording... because I played so much with J-Tram, I just kind of had him come in and redo pretty much all the drums. And Ira from Yesera came and he recorded a little bit on, he redid some bass. And my friend George, Twin Shadow, he ripped a pretty gnarly guitar solo on the record.
Special guest Shred.
It's when you say that because I was listening to the opening track we played, and I was like, there's such a Yesera vibe to this. But in your own way, but the opening is just very strong, Jay Sayer-esque type of thing in all the best ways possible.
I just tried. I just kind of figured that's what was going to happen. So I just, I was like,
which track is it?
Jeeper Creeper. Decided Ira plays on that song.
Yeah.
Actually.
Which is the best way that you can have a Jay Sayer sounding song is by having the dude from Jay Sayer play. That kind of squashes all type of,
All, I just kind of, call a spade, I guess.
No, it's good. And so then how did the DFA thing come around? Shout out to John.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I think John might be listening.
And shout out to Chris.
John and Chris. Hey, guys.
What up, guys?
They were, John was formed. I geeked out on, grew up listening to DFA records, geeked out on John when he came on the show.
Oh, nice. Yeah. He's a lord. He's a true lord. what happened was I released Jeeper Creeper and Runnin' on my own, and just kind of the whole Runnin' thing. It did a lot better than I expected, and just randomly in April I got an email from him and he was really interested in the track and he said he wanted to hear some more music, so I sent him the record and he really liked it, and it just kind of, one thing led to another. It's pretty cool.
I mean, is it really just that easy?
No, it's really not that easy. But
this guy works crazy.
I mean, one of the things we like to share on kids like it, that it is. I mean, you can play it off of like that easy, but it wasn't that easy.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the record's been done for almost 2 years, right? And I've gone through many, many different ups and downs with it, and it is finally now just starting to see the light of day. I've heard the music so much, and playing it live is. Really kind of given it new light, but it's been done for a long time.
I mean, what, for musicians who've been at it, but maybe been toiling in a little bit of the unknown, and now having, being able to come out on DFA, it's like, can you share one of your lowest of lows and to the point that you actually got through it and got to the other side?
Oh, man.
How long do we have?
we got a couple minutes for that answer.
The lowest of lows, man. Well, I recorded... Man, I when we stopped playing with Yesera, it was kind of J-Tram and I. We had a year off before we started everything, and I didn't really have anything in the pipeline at all. And the record was finished, and it seemed like there was some interest, but nothing really happened at all. And I had a few rehearsals with a bunch of people that didn't really work out, and I didn't really know. At all what I was doing. I didn't know if anything was going to happen. Ryan here, my roommate, has always been pretty encouraging and excited about everything I've been doing, but I don't know, man. When you're around to a lot of really creative and talented people that are succeeding so well, and your project doesn't seem to be succeeding on that level, you sensationalize all your feelings, and you think I had 80 cents in my bank account and living in New York, and was in a really crappy relationship with somebody, and
So you're saying roommates
now all changed.
Yeah. Roommates, bandmates got you through it.
Yeah, yeah. These are my family, everyone here is really been super encouraging and exciting.
I mean, I feel like it's important to share those stories mm-hmm. alongside the, I got the record deal that's coming out next month, yeah. just to kind of give a little hope to all the people who are writing good music and toiling alone, that like everyone yeah. feels those lows. Like there's not a single person that has not felt that epic, yeah. soul-crushing low.
I once lost the Yesayer band computer on tour and thought I was going to get fired. And
it was after you set J-Tram's pants on fire.
Yeah.
How did you lose it?
I set J-Tram's pants on fire. I lost the band computer and I was...
There's a longer story to that, which we don't have
to... Yeah, we don't have
to... Was that part of the drink too much advice?
That wasn't drink too much. That was... another.
Why don't we'll leave it at that. All right, let's
do drugs.
Yeah, don't do drugs. Let's rip another song. How about that?
Okay.
What are we gonna hear?
We're gonna hear "Running," okay. the song you played a little bit earlier.
Great.
Featuring Bugs.
I don't mean to let you down. I gotta keep on running until my body's all but broken down. Gotta keep on running.
Yeah. So many vibes. Can we get one of those applause sounds, please, from the room? Just
that one?
I couldn't hear the vibes. That was the problem.
Yeah, the vibes can be felt all around. That was amazing.
Some New Year's vibes.
So you have some upcoming shows, right? You just got done with the residency at Zebulon.
Yeah.
How is I love that place. And actually, your vibes fit quite well in Zebulon.
It was a vibe. That's definitely what it was.
They sell the best.
Each time we say that word.
What did you say? There's
shout
one
to,
more Z.
Shout out to Caveman.
I enjoy their potato chips they serve at Zebulon's. They have certainly good bagged potato chips.
Really?
Yeah, their potato chips are great.
Right?
Yeah.
Every week.
The mozzarella sand.
Yeah.
Like,
they actually have surprisingly, secretly good bar food.
Well, yeah, they do.
Really?
Yeah. It's a bunch of French guys, right, that own it?
Yeah, they're the French Bohemian.
French.
Yeah,
it's definitely.
When you say French Bohemian, I just think like a carafe of wine in hand at all times.
Yeah,
no, I think Zebulon sort of is definitely a place of older Brooklyn.
Yep.
Like it's a movie thing, jazz, DJ, cafe.
Yeah, older Brooklyn. Yeah.
Older Brooklyn, I mean, like 5-10 years ago.
Yeah. We live not older like shootout druggy Brooklyn.
No.
Yeah.
We live right down the street from there, and it's always a scene.
Don't blow up our spot.
I mean, our spot's getting blown up by a wrecking ball in 3 months anyway. Yeah. So
that's the new Brooklyn.
That's that new.
So where are you? Where you come? You're playing a couple shows in September, right?
Yeah, we're playing Music Hall of Williamsburg on Sunday the 23rd with Lee Scratch Perry, which we're all really
excited. No big deal.
No big deal.
Yeah,
we're playing at Death by Audio on the 27th with Sun Ra, and we're playing the DeKalb Market. They're having a big blowout party at the end of the month on the 30th.
So who's playing the DeKalb Market Party?
Man, you know, I don't know.
Okay,
that's a good place.
Yeah.
That place is, it's like this place.
It's also shipping containers. It's all shipping.
Yeah.
Have you been out there?
Yeah, we go, Mikey lives right next to us, so we always grab coffee, and there's this really awesome place that makes these, like,
chicken biscuit sandwiches.
Mm-hmm. Are just so
can you please elaborate?
Yeah.
Please elaborate, like, is it the biscuit and the chicken in there, or like, what makes it so?
Chicken's biscuit, coleslaw.
The buttermilk biscuit with chicken gravy biscuit, and fried chicken in the middle.
Some coleslaw.
You guys cook a lot? You guys got your places to eat on the road?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's a lot. Bill's in Brighton. Brighton, England.
That's
is
the only spot.
One of the...
Bill's?
It's called
shout
Bill's.
Out to Sheets.
Big up the Bill's.
Yeah, what's Bill's?
Bill's is like a
really awesome farm market place. It's like everything is organic and everything is
and
really,
it's always changing. Big lofty
yeah.
spot, you know.
You can go in there. You go in there. It kind of looks like just like a farmer's market, but with a lot of tables. Everything is just really fresh and delicious. I mean, when you go on tour, that's the one thing that kind of blows your mind because you're eating like mustard packets and Coors Light all day.
Yeah, it's a shot of mustard right. and the Coors Light, right?
Yeah.
Like a lime with a ketchup chaser. Awesome.
Really
so let's get all the nuts and bolts. Where can people find you? Where can people get your music?
Website, Friendster, lipsticks and cigarettes profile.
You always make Friendster. That joke, and it always works.
It's a new band every week, and they haven't heard the other shows.
Check out our podcast.
Yeah.
Sinkane.com.
Sinkane.
Sinkane Twitter, Sinkane Raw on Facebook. What else?
Well, and then DFA
Records. Yeah.
When's the release date?
October 23rd.
Can you pre-order?
Man, this should be coming up pretty soon. Chris, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I know he's listening.
Well, how
about
we say if they email Chris, I'll put him on the pre-order list.
Yeah.
And
he'll really enjoy that too.
Release party? Dance party?
October 23rd, we're playing a show at the Brooklyn Bowl.
Oh, perfect.
So,
fried chicken?
Oh, yeah.
So much fried chicken.
Yeah.
Hey, here's my question to you. What is your process of eating when you play Brooklyn Bowl? Are you a before show eater, or you gotta wait till after?
Yeah. Well, I really like the fried chicken, and I gotta do that afterwards or else.
We're clearly divided on this.
I'm kind of like a wingman during the set type of thing, just... You know, in between.
Yeah, I like. I
get greasy fingers.
Yeah, I get a dozen. I get six on table one, six on table two. But yeah, it's so tempting because you're there for so long and you know you want to dig in. But that's
yeah. I mean, it is.
That's the reward.
It is a very good place to eat.
Three more songs till chicken wings.
Yeah.
Two more songs till chicken wings.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I'm
at. One more song till boozy milkshake, right?
I can only... I can't do that one. That's the ender. If I have that, then
That's on the way out. Margarita in one hand, boozy milkshake anyway. All right, one more song, then we're out.
Yeah,
then we're off to Jersey.
Off to Jersey to the aunt's house for Rosh Hashanah. Thank you guys for all coming in here. This was totally worth all the effort.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, what's the last song called?
It's called Young Trouble. This is a new joint.
Oh, and hold on, sorry. One big shout out. Tomorrow night up at Dinosaur Barbecue, Marcus Samuelson and a whole bunch of Harlem chefs are doing an incredible, incredible, incredible food event. Check it out. It's going to be awesome. Yeah. All right.
I'll jack it up a little bit so we
can hear it. Okay.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Thanks for listening.